Blog Talk Radio.
Praise and thanks. Mojuba Akoda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Alua Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ojeremo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun to all the God children, Mojuba Egun to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by New Power Radio Network, the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, AAES, the All African Empowerment Society, Manhood, Race, Culture, the Free Ohio Movement, and last but not least, Unity Design. Please reach out to us on Facebook at Shine of the Times New Power Radio Network. Myself is Queen Tahira, You also can reach us via phone at 330-366-6838. 330-366-6838. Please reach out to us. Let us know what you think about the broadcast. Let us know what we can do to support you in your community and your endeavors with building and uplifting African people throughout the state, throughout your city, and throughout the U.S. We are a national broadcast based out of Cincinnati, Ohio. So shout out to all my loved ones and family and friends here in this one horse town we call Cincinnati. But we're working on it, y'all. We're working on it. It's my understanding that there's some sort of black agenda being proposed for this city. But the black agenda needs to be nationwide, and it needs to be unified. And the first thing that we need to address is the mass incarceration and over-prosecution of our confined citizens, our brothers and sisters who just want a second chance. Many of us have seen in the media over the past few months where if you have money, you can pretty much circumvent the system. You can pretty much pay your way out of any sort of crime that you may commit. And needless to say, it's very unfair, very unethical, very immoral that many of our brothers who are confined through the freedom movement and other movements that are out here advocating for the liberation of our people, these brothers are often submitted to inhumane conditions while they're simply, if you will, trying to pay their debt to society. Shout out to all my brothers in the Free Alabama and sisters in the Free Alabama movement, Free Mississippi movement, California, to New Jersey, from Florida to Canada. So thank you, everybody. And I really want to thank those that participated in September 9th demonstration around the U.S. and around the world. We have gotten the attention of the world, everybody. So keep the pressure on. Shout out to our beloved brother, King Dot, Jaja, Roz, all the people, 13, who have been subjected to retribution and punishment simply for speaking truth to power. So we're going to start all over, y'all. We're going to go back all the way to Reconstruction because this is this is Reconstruction 2016. And as we move into 2017, by then we should have an agenda in place that definitely is going to allow our brothers who do speak truth to power, whether they be confined or free, to advocate and do the things that they need to do in our community, including making sure that if it is time for them to be set free, if there's been some shit in the gang, that we expose that and call it for what it is. So tonight we're going to listen to a little bit about Reconstruction. I'm going to take us through a history lesson of our condition. And so I ask that you bear with me because, as you can see, I'm multitasking. That's Aria in the background that you heard. She's got Elmo going on one laptop, and I've got this broadcast going on the desktop. So so that there's not a lot of noise in the background, I am going to be muted. But if you do want to come into the conversation, simply push 1. If you're listening online, please dial in at 917-889-8059, and I will be sure to open you up. The reason why we're going back all the way to the Reconstruction period is because supposedly that's when we were set free. But as we look at the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, we cannot separate those because they were supposedly done for the betterment of us and on our behalf. But yet we still have people being subjected to the Casual Killing Act, which is why a lot of the murders that you see out here in the community, the majority of them go unpunished. If anything, these criminals are often rewarded. So we're going to get this thing going. If you want to come into the conversation, please push 1. The number to dial in is 917-889-8059, 917-889-8059. We'll see you on the other side, everybody. Tomorrow night we're going to have Imam Hassan's attorney Kerger on Sign of the Times from 6 to 8 p. So we're looking forward to getting an update from him on the well-being of our beloved brother, Imam Sadiq Hassan. And we wish those who are being subjected to retribution from the action on Friday, we're sending them good vibrations and good thoughts. So we'll be back on the other side, y'all. Thank you.
Hi, I'm John Green. This is Crash Course U.S. History, and huzzah! The Civil War is over! The slaves are free! Huzzah! That one hit me in the head. It's a very dangerous crash course.
So when you say don't aim at a person, that includes myself?
The roller coaster only goes up from here, my friends. Huzzah!
Mr. Green, what about the epic failure of Reconstruction?
Oh, right. Stupid Reconstruction, always ruining everything. So after the Civil War ended, the United States had to reintegrate both a formerly slave population and a formerly rebellious population back into the country, which is a challenge that we might have met, except Abraham Lincoln was assassinated and we were left with Andrew I am the third worst president ever Johnson.
I'm sorry, Abe, but you don't get to be in the show anymore.
So Lincoln's whole post-war idea was to facilitate reunion and reconciliation, and Andrew Johnson's guiding Reconstruction principle was that the South never had a right to secede in the first place. Also, because he was himself a Southerner, he resented all the elites in the South who had snubbed him, and he was also a racist who didn't think that blacks should have any role in Reconstruction. Trifecta! So between 1865 and 1867, the so-called period of presidential Reconstruction, Johnson appointed provisional governors and ordered them to call state conventions to establish new, all-white governments. And in their 100% whiteness and oppression of former slaves, those new governments looked suspiciously like the old Confederate governments they had replaced. And what was changing for the former slaves? Well, in some ways, a lot. Like Fisk and Howard universities were established, as well as many primary and secondary schools, thanks in part to the Freedmen's Bureau, which only lasted until 1870, but had the power to divide up confiscated and abandoned Confederate land for former slaves. And this was very important, because to most slaves, land ownership was the key to freedom, and many felt like they'd been promised land by the Union Army, like General Sherman's Field Order 15 promised to distribute land in 40-acre plots to former slaves. But that didn't happen, either through the Freedmen's Bureau or anywhere else. Instead, President Johnson ordered all land returned to its former owners, so the South remained largely agricultural, with the same people owning the same land, and in the end, we ended up with sharecropping. Let's go to the thought bubble. The system of sharecropping replaced slavery in many places throughout the South. Landowners would provide housing to the sharecroppers. No, thought bubble, not quite that nice. There you go. Also, tools and seed, and then the sharecroppers received, get this, a share of their crop, usually between a third and a half, with the price for that harvest often set by the landowner. Freed blacks got to control their work, and plantation owners got a steady workforce that couldn't easily leave because they had little opportunity to save money and make the big capital investments in, like, land or tools. By the late 1860s, poor white farmers were sharecropping as well. In fact, by the Great Depression, most sharecroppers were white. And while sharecropping certainly wasn't slavery, it did result in a quasi-serfdom that tied workers to land they didn't own, more or less the opposite of Jefferson's ideal of the small, independent farmer. So the Republicans in Congress weren't happy that this reconstructed South looked so much like the pre-Civil War South, so they took the lead in Reconstruction after 1867. Radical Republicans felt the war had been fought for equal rights and wanted to see the powers of the national government expanded. Few were as radical as Thaddeus Tommy Lee Jones Stephens, who wanted to take away land from the Southern planters and give it to the former slaves, but rank-and-file Republicans were radical enough to pass the Civil Rights Bill, which defined persons born in the United States as citizens and established nationwide equality before the law, regardless of race. Andrew Johnson immediately vetoed the law, claiming that trying to protect the rights of African Americans amounted to discrimination against white people, which so infuriated Republicans that Congress did something it had never done before in all of American history. They overrode the presidential veto with a two-thirds majority, and the Civil Rights Act became law. So then Congress really had its dander up and decided to amend the Constitution with the 14th Amendment, which defines citizenship, guarantees equal protection, and extends the rights in the Bill of Rights to all the states, sort of. The amendment had almost no Democratic support, but it also didn't need any, because there were almost no Democrats in Congress on account of how Congress had refused to seat the representatives from the new all-white governments that Johnson supported. And that's how we got the 14th Amendment, arguably the most important in the whole Constitution. Thanks, Thought Bubble. Oh, straight to the mystery document today? All right. The rules here are simple. I guess the author of the mystery document and try not to get shocked. All right, let's see what we got today. Section 1. Be it ordained by the police jury of the parish of St. Landry that no Negro shall be allowed to pass within limits of said parish without special permit in writing from his employer. Section 4. Every Negro is required to be in the regular service of some white person or former owner who shall be held responsible for the conduct of said Negro. Section 6, no Negro shall be permitted to preach, exhort, or otherwise declaim to congregations of colored people without a special permission in writing from the president of the police jury. Gee, Stan, I wonder if the president of the police jury was white. I actually know this one. It is a black code, which was basically legal codes where they just replaced the word slave with the word Negro. And this code shows just how unwilling white governments were to ensure the rights of new free citizens. I would celebrate not getting shocked, but now I am depressed. So, okay, in 1867, again over Johnson's veto, Congress passed the Reconstruction Act, which divided the South into five military districts and required each state to create a new government, one that included participation of black men. Those new governments had to ratify the 14th Amendment if they wanted to get back into the Union. Radical Reconstruction had begun. So in 1868, Andrew Johnson was about as electable in the U.S. as Jefferson Davis, and sure enough, he didn't win. Instead, the 1868 election was won by Republican and former Union General Ulysses S. Grant. But Grant's margin of victory was small enough that Republicans were like, man, we would sure win more elections if black people could vote, which is something you hear Republicans say all the time these days. So congressional Republicans pushed through the 15th Amendment, which prohibited states from denying men the right to vote based on race, but not based on gender or literacy or whether your grandfather could vote. So states ended up with a lot of leeway when it came to denying the franchise to African Americans, which of course they did. So here we have the federal government dictating who can vote and who is and isn't a citizen of a state and establishing equality under the law, even local law. And this is a really big deal in American history because the national government became, rather than a threat to individual liberty, the custodian of freedom, as radical Republican Charles Sumner put it. So, but with this legal protection, former slaves began to exercise their rights. They participated in the political process by direct action, such as staging sit-ins to integrate streetcars, by voting in elections, and by holding office. Most African Americans were Republicans at the time, and because they could vote and were a large part of the population, the Republican Party came to dominate politics in the South, just like today, except totally different. Now, Southern mythology about the age of radical Reconstruction is exemplified by Gone with the Wind, which of course tells the story of Northern Republican dominance and corruption by Southern Republicans. Fortune-seeking Northern carpetbaggers seen here, as well as Southern turncoat scalawags, dominated politics, and all of the African American elected leaders were either corrupt or puppets or both. Yeah, well, like the rest of Gone with the Wind, that's a bit of an oversimplification. There were about 2,000 African Americans who held office during Reconstruction, and the vast majority of them were not corrupt. Consider, for example, the not corrupt and amazingly named Pinckney B.S. Pinchback, who from 1872 to 1873 served very briefly in Louisiana as America's first black governor, and went on to be a senator and a member of the House of Representatives. By the way, America's second African American governor, Douglas Wilder of Virginia, was elected in 1989. Having African American office holders was a huge step forward in terms of ensuring the rights of African Americans because it meant that there would be black juries and less discrimination in state and local governments when it came to providing basic services. But in the end, Republican governments failed in the South. There were important achievements, especially a school system that, while segregated, did attempt to educate both black and white children. And even more importantly, they created a functioning government where both white and African American citizens could participate. According to one white South Carolina lawyer, we have gone through one of the most remarkable changes in our relations to each other that has been known perhaps in the history of the world. That's a little hyperbolic, but we are America after all. It's true that corruption was widespread, but it was in the North, too. I mean, we're talking about governments. And that's not why Reconstruction really ended. It ended because, one, things like schools and road repair cost money, which meant taxes, which made Republican governments very unpopular because Americans hate taxes. And two, white Southerners could not accept African Americans exercising basic civil rights, holding office, or voting. And for many, the best way to return things to the way they were before Reconstruction was through violence. Especially after 1867, much of the violence directed toward African Americans in the South was politically motivated. The Ku Klux Klan was founded in 1866, and it quickly became a terrorist organization targeting Republicans, both black and white, beating and murdering men and women in order to intimidate them and keep them from voting. The worst act of violence was probably the massacre at Colfax, Louisiana, where hundreds of former slaves were murdered. And between intimidation and emerging discriminatory voting laws, fewer black men voted, which allowed white Democrats to take control of state governments in the South and returned
white Democratic congressional delegations to Washington. These white Southern politicians called themselves redeemers because they claimed to have redeemed the South from Northern Republican corruption and black rule. Now, it's likely that the South would have fallen back into Democratic hands eventually, but the process was aided by Northern Republicans losing interest in Reconstruction. In 1873, the U.S. fell into yet another not-quite-great economic depression, and Northerners lost the stomach to fight for the rights of black people in the South, which, in addition to being hard, was expensive. So by 1876, the supporters of Reconstruction were in full retreat, and the Democrats were resurgent, especially in the South. And this set up one of the most contentious elections in American history. The Democrats nominated New York Governor and NYU Law School graduate Samuel Tilden. The Republicans chose Ohio Governor and Kenyon College alumnus Rutherford B. Hayes. One man who'd gone to crash course writer Raoul Myers Law School, and another who'd gone to my college, Kenyon. Now, if this election had been based on facial hair, as elections should be, there would have been no controversy. But sadly, we have an electoral college here in the United States, and in 1876, there were disputed electoral votes in South Carolina, Louisiana, and of course, Florida. Now, you might remember that in these situations, there is a constitutional provision that says Congress should decide the winner, but Congress, shockingly, proved unable to accomplish something. So they appointed a 15-man electoral commission, a super committee, if you will, and there were 8 Republicans on that committee and 7 Democrats, so you will never guess who won. Kenyon College's own Rutherford B. Hayes. Go, lords and ladies! And yes, that is our mascot. Shut up. Anyway, in order to get the presidency and win the support of the supercommittee, Hayes's people agreed to cede control of the South to the Democrats and to stop meddling in Southern affairs, and also to build a transcontinental railroad through Texas. This is called the Bargain of 1877 because historians are so good at naming things, and it basically killed Reconstruction. Without any more federal troops in Southern states, and with control of Southern legislatures firmly in the hands of white Democrats, the states were free to go back to restricting the freedom of black people. Which they did. Legislatures passed Jim Crow laws that limited African Americans' access to public accommodations and legal protections. States passed laws that took away black people's right to vote, and social and economic mobility among African Americans in the South declined precipitously. However, for a brief moment, the United States was more democratic than it had ever been before, and an entire segment of the population that had no impact on politics before was now allowed to participate. And for the freedmen who lived through it, that was a monumental change, and it would echo down to the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s, sometimes called the Second Reconstruction. But we're going to end this episode on a downer, as we are wont to do here at Crash Course U.S. History, because I want to point out a lesser-known legacy of Reconstruction. The Reconstruction amendments and laws that were passed granted former slaves political freedom and rights, especially the vote, and that was critical. But to give them what they really wanted and needed, plots of land that would make them economically independent, would have required confiscation, and that violation of property rights was too much for all but the most radical Republicans. And that question of what it really means to be free in a system of free market capitalism has proven very complicated indeed. I'll see you next week. Crash Course is produced and directed by Stan Muller. Our script supervisor is Meredith Danko. The associate producer is Danica Johnson. The show is written by my high school history teacher, Raoul Meyer, and myself, and our graphics team is Thought Cafe. Every week, there's a new caption for the Libertage. You can suggest those in comments, where you can also ask questions about today's video that will be answered by our team of historians. Thank you for watching Crash Course. Don't forget to subscribe, and as we say in my hometown, don't forget to be awesome.
The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution are referred to as the Reconstruction Amendments. Passed in the 5 years after the end of the Civil War, each amendment addressed specific issues regarding slavery, citizenship, and suffrage. Now, as we know, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation freed slaves only in the states in rebellion that were under federal control. In order to make sure that slavery was permanently eliminated throughout the United States, including border states with slavery such as Kentucky, Congress passed the 13th Amendment in 1865. The 13th Amendment assured that all slaves were declared free. The amendment used both the terms slavery and involuntary servitude. The only exception was in cases of punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. This exception allowed for the use of slave labor by the state in regard to prison inmates. What the 13th Amendment did not do was define the status of freed slaves. Were they citizens? Did they have the same rights as other Americans? In order to retain as much control as possible over former slaves, and to restore the political, economic, and social status quo, new Southern state governments began enacting black codes. While these state laws gave freedmen certain legal rights, it also imposed strict race-based restrictions and made them second-class citizens in the South. again. Congress tried to fix this problem of discrimination by passing the Freedmen's Bureau Act and the Civil Rights Act of 1866. President Andrew Johnson vetoed both bills, but Congress overrode his veto. Then, when Johnson demonstrated his unwillingness to enforce the Civil Rights Act, Congress passed the 14th Amendment in 1866, making it part of the Constitution. The amendment, the 14th Amendment, has three important parts. Anyone born in the United States is a citizen, and it was specifically aimed at African-American citizenship. The government must provide all citizens with due process of law, meaning that everyone's legal rights must be respected. And the government must provide equal protection of the laws, making sure it treats all citizens the same, regardless of race. The Supreme Court will eventually use the amendment to make the Bill of Rights apply to the states. It's called incorporation. The 14th Amendment, called by some the Civil Rights Amendment, was a huge step towards equality for African Americans and eventually for all minority groups in the United States, but it was not completely enforced after ratification, leading to the need for a civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s. It's still an important amendment today, and it is easily the most important change to the Constitution since the Bill of Rights. Now, voting rights for African Americans remained a sticky point despite ratification of the 14th Amendment. Former Confederates and President Johnson did not want African Americans to vote in the South, and black men generally did not have voting rights in most northern states. Congress therefore passed the 15th Amendment in 1869, ratified in 1870. According to the amendment, the right to vote could not be denied on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. In other words, African American men had the right to vote in every state. But the amendment did fail to address gender. The 15th Amendment, however, did not stop newly admitted southern states from placing legal conditions on voting, such as literacy tests and poll taxes. These state laws effectively deprived the very people the amendment targeted from political participation. Future amendments and civil rights acts would resolve those issues, but not for almost a century.
Given what most Americans believe, the next statement may be more shocking than any previous. The fact is, the United States is not a country, but a corporation contractually created by the Constitution. Your state is a country, per the law, and your original citizenship is of that country. Our founders instituted themselves to be first and foremost citizens of their respective states. As of 1787, those states already had formed a union, and they created the Constitution for the purpose of perfecting that union in forming a national government. They did not intend that the new nation have any jurisdiction or powers over the states or their citizens that were not specifically enumerated in the Constitution. They stated this point quite clearly in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution. They granted the United States exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may become the seat of the government of the United States, our District of Columbia, and to exercise authority over all places purchased by the consent of the states. And that is all. The framers further secured the rights of the people with the 9th and 10th Amendments in the Bill of Rights. In the 9th, they established that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And in the 10th, they made clear that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. The only way the federal government can have any jurisdiction beyond these constitutional clauses is by written permission or contract. Which leads us to another piece of the puzzle, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, ratified in 1868 following the Civil War. As barbaric as it may sound today, the black slaves, prior to the conclusion of the Civil War, were legally considered to be property, with none of the rights or privileges of free-born people, only duties. The money interests took advantage of America's desire to free the slaves and found a way to use the swiftly adopted post-war constitutional amendments to enslave all of the people. The deceit is in the wording of both the 13th and 14th Amendments. You will note that the 13th Amendment provides that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the United States. But why the emphasis on involuntary servitude? Isn't it the same thing as slavery? Sure it is. But they had to mention the concept of involuntary servitude because they wished to retain another type of slavery, voluntary servitude. Voluntary servitude is an ancient and established concept. It was the way serfs became subjects to their lords during feudal times in England and other European countries. It was a way for free men to earn a living at a time when all property was held by a select few, and thus anyone who wanted to farm and support their family had first to agree to be subject to a lord of the land. Our forefathers hated this concept and designed our Constitution to exclude titles of nobility, making all Americans sovereign. The 14th Amendment turned the intention of the founders on its ear by making voluntary servitude a requirement for former slaves to gain the rights already guaranteed to free-born United States citizens. When the slaves were released from their involuntary servitude following the war, their status was changed from that of being property to that of being a person. But being a person still entitled them to none of the rights associated with citizenship. So the 14th Amendment ostensibly was written to provide the former slaves with the same constitutional rights of freeborn American citizens, but only if they agreed first to become subject to the jurisdiction of the corporate United States, making oneself paramountly, that is, first subject to the jurisdiction of the laws of the United States, however, limits access to parts of the Bill of Rights, as we'll explain in a moment. But first remember, anyone who voluntarily subjects himself to the laws or jurisdiction of another is, in every way, obligated to abide by the terms of any contracts or laws established by whomever establishes the rules of the contract.
In 1868, the 14th Amendment was ratified, ending slavery by giving all Americans citizenship. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the states wherein they reside. United States Code, Annotated Amendment 14. However, what the public was not told, that while under the Lieber Code, a 14th Amendment citizen can only be found within the jurisdiction of the United States, that is, all government employees, all those who live in territories occupied by the federal government, such as Washington, D.C., and the former slaves. The rest of the population was not subject to the 14th Amendment, and thus could still claim jurisdiction under the original Constitution. In addition to that, after the conclusion of the Civil War, the federal government was now occupying the southern states, placing these captured citizens under the jurisdiction of the Lieber Code. The southern states had to agree to ratify this amendment in order for them to be granted their freedom from federal rule. Thus, instead of ending slavery, the 14th Amendment held all southerners captive as slaves in the plantation known as the United States of America. Just like how all citizens were turned into corporations in 1790 to subject them to the Revolutionary War debts, 14th Amendment citizens were created to be franchisees, subject to the corporation known as the United States Incorporated. And like all corporate brands, you do not have any constitutional Bill of Rights protections. Proof of such can be found in the all caps version of your name, which signifies a corporate entity. After the Civil War, the United States defaulted on its war debt. During the bankruptcy proceedings, cunning lawyers in league with international bankers found a loophole within Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the United States Constitution, which allowed the creation of a duplicate entity known as the Corporation of the United States of America to replace the now bankrupt and defunct Republic of the United States of America. This occurred with the passage of the District of Columbia Organic Act of 1871, which incorporated the area of the District of Columbia into a private foreign corporation chartered in the City of London known as the United States Incorporated. This corporation designated Congress as the Board of Directors to continue the business needs of the government under martial law. Thanks to the Lieber Code, federal jurisdiction under the Organic Act was expanded to include not only all captured citizens in the southern states, but all Americans in all states. Thus, America had lost her sovereignty under the yoke of the Crown of England and the international bankers. During the same time, the Corporation of the United States adopted its own constitution, which was identical to the original national constitution. To fool the people, one word was changed from its original form, the Constitution for the United States of America, to its present-day all-capitalized form, which signifies a corporate entity, the Constitution of the United States of America. Incidentally, the Titles and Nobility Amendment was removed from this new Constitution. With the Illuminati in full control over the United States, they now sought to rule the world. After the death of Adam Weishaupt in 1830, Giuseppe Mazzini was selected to head the Illuminati. In 1871, the mantle of power was passed on again to the American General Albert Pike as its new director. Pike became fascinated with the idea of a one-world government and eventually constructed the Illuminati's blueprint of world domination. His plans called for the financing of three world wars in the 20th century. The first war would bring about an atheist communist state from the ashes of Tsarist Russia. The second war would bring about a Jewish Holocaust under a fascist government to ferment support of a Zionist state of Israel. The third war would manipulate the differences of Christians and Muslims for their own annihilation. Then finally, political Zionism would come out as victors of all. These three world wars would require enormous funding. Since most of the royalty in Europe was already deeply in debt thanks to the numerous wars and conflicts created by the Rothschild banking dynasty, the only place left that could possibly pay for such ambitious plans was the now prosperous American Republic. After the Civil War, the United States went through a great industrial expansion. The new industries of oil, steel, textile, and railroad all needed generous financing, which the Rothschild family was more than eager to provide. To access these markets, the Rothschilds sent their agent, Jacob Schiff, to infiltrate the New York banking scene, which was controlled by J.P. Morgan. By the turn of the century, the Rothschilds had fully entrenched themselves into the tight fraternity of Wall Street banks, such as Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers. They now sought their most prized possession, full control over the American monetary system. With help from Jacob Schiff and J.P. Morgan, the Rothschilds formed a scheme which would seduce Congress into relinquishing control over the money supply. This occurred with the Panic of 1907, when a liquidity crisis caused many banks and businesses to fail all across the United States. The meltdown began when J.P. Morgan published rumors that the Knickerbocker Trust Company of New York was insolvent. With a bank run on hand, they were forced to call in their loans, creating a chain reaction which would threaten to implode the entire banking system. The failures continued until J.P. Morgan and Company provided a generous loan to the insolvent banks. But J.P. Morgan was not trying to save the American banking system, but rather, he used the crisis to destroy his competition by choosing which banks he would bail out. But the biggest casualty of the economic fallout was the looming bankruptcy of the Corporation of the United States, which had no means to pay back their loans, which were due in 1912. In anticipation of this bankruptcy, representatives from the world's most powerful families met in November 1910 at a secret meeting at the Jekyll Island Club Resort in Georgia to discuss the foreclosure of the Corporation of the United States and to brainstorm solutions which will prevent future liquidity crises such as occurred during the Panic of 1907. Those in attendance included Senator Nelson Aldrich, Paul Warburg, representatives from J.P. Morgan & Company, and Jacob Schiff, representing the Rothschild family. They proposed a 20-year extension on the national debt if the United States would agree to charter a privately owned central bank, which would serve as a bank of last resort by lending money to other insolvent banks in order to prevent future bank runs. A week later, they emerged with their plans to create what is known as the Federal Reserve System. Because the current President Taft would never agree to sign away the American monetary system to a cabal of international bankers, they waited until they got their man, the progressive Woodrow Wilson, into power. In return for the bankers' generous campaign contributions, Woodrow Wilson reluctantly promised the bankers he would sign the Federal Reserve Act if he was elected into office. Many powerful forces were opposed to the creation of a privately controlled central bank. To neutralize this threat, J.P. Morgan invited the major opponents of the Federal Reserve Act on board the maiden voyage of the newly built Titanic luxury steam liner built by the White Star Line, owned by J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan ordered the captain to steer his ship into an iceberg and under gunpoint prevented the men from escaping onto the lifeboats, killing many of his enemies in one large swoop. When word of this got back to Woodrow Wilson, he commented, "There exists this power in the world, so subtle, so organized, so watchful, that we dare not speak above a whisper when we speak in condemnation of it." At the beginning of 1913, the United States had defaulted on its debt. After being denied a new line of credit, the now President Woodrow Wilson faced a constitutional crisis. With no other sources of funding, he went along with the bankers' schemes engineered at the Jekyll Island Resort. To avoid any opposition, Senator Nelson Aldrich quickly pushed the Federal Reserve Act through both houses of Congress. On December 23, 1913, while most of Congress was away on Christmas vacation, a quorum call was issued. A few selected congressional traitors voted by voice to avoid public record and pass the Federal Reserve Act, which President Wilson signed into law. Wilson later admitted with remorse when referring to the Fed, "I have unwittingly ruined my country." This act gave away the keys of the printing presses at the U.S. Treasury to a foreign corporation chartered under the Crown of England, known as the Federal Reserve Bank.
The Federal Reserve was created by Congress in 1913, and it was entrusted with the power, granted originally to the Congress by the U.S. Constitution, to coin money and regulate the value thereof.
The Federal Reserve Bank advertises itself as a non-profit corporation that operates as if it's another branch of the government. However, its board members are unelected, and their meetings are conducted behind the closed doors away from public scrutiny.
The board of directors of the Federal Reserve System is chosen by the president from a list prepared by the bankers themselves.
It's important that whomever I pick is viewed as an independent person from politics.
All this secrecy becomes very suspicious, considering how the Federal Reserve monitors and controls trillions of dollars within the world's banking system. After the federal government lost its ability to issue its own money, the national debt soon soared to astronomical heights, because now the government had to pay the Federal Reserve interest on all its currency printed to circulation. But this interest on the national debt could never be repaid, as the Federal Reserve required all debts to be repaid with gold, which the government did not have. And even worse, the interest portion of the national debt was not issued into the money supply. In other words, more and more debt would have to be issued to continue servicing the growing interest payment on all loans. In order to cover this interest payment, Congress was forced to pass the income tax legislation, which became law in 1913 with the ratification of the 16th Amendment, also known as the Income Tax Amendment. Initially, they levied a 1% voluntary tax on all incomes over $3,000 and a progressive surtax on all incomes over $20,000, but this would soon increase with the outbreak of World War I and World War II. Income tax allowed the Federal Reserve System to confiscate the earnings of the common man. But the industrialists and financiers were exempted from paying any income tax because they could afford to hide their assets in tax-free foundations, which they claimed were devoted to philanthropy. Examples of such include the Rockefeller Foundation, the Mellon Foundation, and the Carnegie Endowment.
The main purpose of the income tax is not to raise revenue, but to redistribute wealth and to control society.
Technically, the 16th Amendment was not ratified by the necessary states as it violates the constitutional clause of no direct taxes. Despite this, Congress went ahead and taxed the people anyway. The government was able to do this because under their corporate charter, Congress was operating as the board of directors, and therefore they had the authority to enter this amendment as ratified. But remember, this amendment has nothing to do with the original United States Constitution, which was replaced back in 1871 with the corporate constitution.
It's actually very simple. Congress tried to enact an income tax in 1894. The Supreme Court said that's unconstitutional. When the Supreme Court says something is unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional. They tried again in 1913, and the Supreme Court said the 16th Amendment conferred no new power of taxation. So if they didn't have it then, and they didn't get it, they don't have it. There is no constitutional basis for a tax on the wages of Americans living and working in the 50 states of the Union. Period. End of argument.
In 1933, the United States once again declared bankruptcy. To make all citizens subject to repayment of the national debt, the bankers chartered a Delaware corporation known as the Bureau of Internal Revenue. But this corporation was illegally masquerading as part of the government, placing them under constant threat of lawsuit. To escape this litigation, they moved their jurisdiction outside of the United States to Puerto Rico. This occurred in 1953 when they changed their name to the Internal Revenue Service, or IRS, incorporated as a Puerto Rican trust within the division of the Department of the Treasury of the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. Further proof can be found within the United States Code, which lists the IRS as Trust Fund Number 62, the Puerto Rico Special Fund Internal Revenue. This was done to divert all income tax payments to the International Monetary Fund, owned by the various central banks of Europe and North America, which in turn are owned by the Crown of England.
There is a substantial, conclusive body of evidence that proves that our income tax system represents the most pernicious form of tyranny. It is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated by government against the working men and women of America.
I could eliminate all income taxes tomorrow and have more than enough money to fund the government by using some other guy's bright idea. We tax the Federal Reserve at 0.0006, doubles our money until we decide to put them out of business permanently, because we certainly should not have central banks.
The evidence proving income tax is paid to the United Kingdom is found deep within the IRS individual master file, which contains every transaction and financial record gathered by IRS officials throughout your lifetime. One of these codes determines what kind of tax you're paying. After looking this code up within the IRS 6209 manual, you find that they have incorrectly classified all Americans as domiciled corporations in either Guam, the Virgin Islands, or Puerto Rico. Furthermore, all taxpayers who filled out a 1040 form are subject to a tax for doing commerce with the United Kingdom under a treaty with the United States.
There is no law. There is no law that requires the average American worker in the private sector to pay a direct unapportioned tax on their labor and compensation for services. There is no law.
As you follow the money trail, you find that the taxes collected on the 1040 form is then sent to the Crown of England as a tribute payment. The Crown of England is a sovereign corporation located within the 677 acres of the city, found within the heart of Greater London. This tiny strip of land contains the world's most powerful banking houses, such as the Bank of England and Lloyd's of London, owned by the House of Rothschild. It is these bankers and their counterpart, the Temple Bar attorneys, that constitute the power base known simply as the Crown. Even though the Queen of England is a member of this club, she is not its corporate head. That job was given to the Pontiff of Rome. The Pope was given control over the monarchy with the signing of the Treaty of 1213 between King John and Pope Innocent III, which forever pledged England as a vassal state of the Holy Roman Empire. In 1297, that treaty was used as a precedent to incorporate the city as an independent city-state controlled by the Vatican, which would govern England without directly relying on the monarchy. Just like how the Corporation of the United States was subject to the Crown of England, so too were the subjects of the British Empire, enslaved with debt by the financial division of the Vatican, headquartered within the City of London. Today, this small clique of bankers have full authority over the affairs of Parliament, and this has been the case since 1694, when Pope Innocent XI hired William of Orange to depose the Stuart kings and charter the Bank of England. Located within the Crown of England is the original Federal Reserve Charter, which according to the Farmer Claims legal team, allocates that 67% of the income tax collected by the IRS was to be divided to the Crown of England. Another 23% was to be paid as a dividend to the 300 shareholders of the Federal Reserve Bank, and the last 10% was to be paid to the employees of the IRS to keep them quiet about this sweet deal. Since 1913, none of the income tax collected by the IRS has gone to the federal government. The federal government is funded totally through black budget sources, such as drug trafficking and off-budget accounting on the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report.
No es necesario, pues, ser gran conocedor de digamos, de la lucha, ni nada de eso. Se ve el alto grado de injusticia, pues. Entonces no necesitas saber tanto de marxismo-leninismo ni cuestiones así, es cuestión práctica, pues, de ver esto y sentirlo, pues, sentir el amor hacia los compañeros campesinos también que están tan marginados. Por eso fue nuestra incorporación a la lucha, para enseñarle a nuestros compañeros campesinos a luchar.
It takes the people from a stage to another stage to another stage. And any program that's revolutionary is an advanced program. Revolution is change, honey, and you just keep on changing. That's what we do. We take the people in there and take them through those changes, and before you know it, they are in fact not only knowing what socialism is, they don't even have to know what it is. They're endorsing and they're participating, they're observing, and they're supporting socialism.
We go by the words and deeds of Amilcar Cabral, who said that we're not fighting for ideas in people's heads. Not vocabulary, not terms. People want a better quality of life and a better future for their children. This song is inspired by the Black Panther Party's Free Breakfast for Children program, which brought the entire community together for the good of something everybody could agree on, the kids. Born in torrential rain of 1980, my generation might seem crazy if it wasn't for the counterinsurgency to eliminate militants, divisions of preference of the government, punishment of the Panthers, elders behind the cell bars, shell-shocked, jail while others got jobs. Forgot I never knew to dedicate their lives to this. Easy to criticize the youth when there's no guiding fist. Confusion in various forms, patriot flags, American dreams, cocaine on the streets. My agent underneath to carry the torch, put flames in the hearts of babies and teens, fulfill their basic needs. Up against an oppressor stronger than ever. Comfort us with possessions, progress in question. Must equip the ghetto with struggle direction. Serve the people, earn the respect. Follow possessors, those who serve the people for survival first. Learn from practice, the kids deserve to eat without a beat. Why the Z smiling? Cause it's a new society. Serve the people for survival first. Learn from practice, the kids deserve to eat without a beat. Why the Z smiling? Cause it's a new society. Plenty of commerce cannot operate in public legal hustling, cause above ground ain't organized enough yet. They turn unwanted circumstances from burdens to further chances to pursue the purpose, revolution of the masses. We will organize and formalize collectives, borderline dying, financial source of our reluctance to be full-time freedom fighters, fortune ties with tenants, in quarter-mile radius, proletariat slumping. Pick your local, building soldiers is your homework, miss the youngsters in the struggle. There's plenty socialists within quotes, but ain't no theory gonna give a kid a winter coat. We brought a larger world liberation movement. Gotta start on the ground and syncopated units. If we value victory, we will demonstrate our trueness. Strip them out of discipline, convey it to recruits and serve the people for survival first. Learn from practice, the kids deserve to eat without a beat. Why the Z smiling? Cause it's a new society. Serve the people for survival first. Learn from practice, the kids deserve to eat without a beat. Why the Z smiling? Cause it's a new society.
After a time, It's by individuals like me, burglars, pimps, drug addicts, people on public assistance, welfare, alcoholics, working these programs that's serving these kids, or working the free health clinics where doctors and nurses are coming to provide services, or free clothing programs for those who are in need, people began to look at us differently. They began to engage us in a very different way, from the skepticism to gradually a sort of intimacy.
Learn from practice the kids deserve to eat without a fee. Why the sea smiling? Cause it's a new society. Serve the people for survival first. Learn from practice the kids deserve to eat without a fee. Why the sea smiling? Cause it's a new society. Serve the people for survival first. Learn from practice the kids deserve to eat without a fee. Why the sea smiling? Cause it's a new society. Serve the people means surrendering yourself to the health of the human family and the land base. Picking up the pieces of race, destroying leaders, crippling our movements with J. Edgar Hoover. Not charity, using poverty for profits. Objects is freedom like Sophia Bukhari. Self-determination, our consciousness evolving. Preparing by sharing, we're already an army. They give us tell us one, we gon' heal us one. Let them know I love billions I ain't even met before. Doing the work that the federal will never do. Ain't anticipating praise on Channel 11 News. Of all the unnecessary. Generosity's a given, sisters, brothers, we all the same. I'll guard you with my life, shelter, listening here, cause we one body, you heart, I'm vain.
To plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Detroit from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
The poem is by Taimbe Jess, and the poem is, when niggas love revolution like they love the bull. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, youth will wear red, black, and green patches over the emblems on their starter jackets. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, brothers will gather regularly at barbershops and corner stops to discuss George Jackson and the handbook of revolutionary warfare and people's war before they go home to take care of their children each night. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, playground basketball courts will become paramilitary training grounds where we learn to shoot guns at the enemy and not baskets for bets. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, we will spend hours and hours watching our children grow into soldiers and not basketball players. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, we will know CIA stats, FBI stats, infant mortality stats, police brutality stats, political prisoners and prisoners of war, and literacy training techniques like we know Paxson's shoe size or Shaq's shoe size or the way we know Rodman or Pippen's rebounds or Grant's salary and all the intimate details of Michael's last gambling spree. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, you will be able to ask any youth on the street, who is Sundiata Okoye? Who is Assata Shakur? Who is Sekou Odinga? Who is Rochelle McGee and Jonathan Jackson? You will be able to ask, who is Matula Shakur? Who is Queen Mother Moore? They will be able to tell you without skipping a beat. Niggas love revolution like they love the bull. You will go on to ask them about Michael Jordan, and they will say, when niggas love revolution like they love the bull, masses of us will go down to tear up Carolina coroner and his office to find out what really happened to James Jordan instead of waiting on the word of newspapers and sheriff's offices. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, we will show up in Washington, D.C. with the Million Man March with our God and with our guns. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, they will start to seriously wonder why one Negro putting a brown ball through a white net makes more mint money in one season than they will make in an entire lifetime, and do something about it. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, you will see Phil Jackson running up and down an empty court minutes before game time screaming, where are my niggas? Where are my niggas? Where are my niggas? As the niggas leave the stadium to go build liberation schools in their community. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, all niggas will refuse to shoot ball with the president, with or without their dashikis on. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, we'll become associated with the sound that CIA agents, snitches, rats, and agent provocateurs who join our organizations and work against the legitimate aspirations of our people who yearn to breathe free, drug dealers and others will make when they are thrown gracefully face first into open manholes. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, Nike will no longer be able to sell $160 basketball shoes in the black community because we would rather spend the money on liberation and revolution, thank you. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull, they will love it, they will love it more than chitlins, more than all my children, more than Jerry Carroll, more than permanent, more than Cadillacs and Mercedes-Benz and Rolls-Royces and BMW's cars. When niggas love revolution like they love the bull. When niggas love their family like they love the bull. When niggas love their children like they love the bulls. When niggas love to be free like they love the bulls. When niggas love struggle like they love the bulls. When niggas love dignity like they love the bulls. When niggas love niggas like they love the bulls. We will become black people and all the bullshit will hit the fan.
Here's part of the proof that the missing, hidden, original 13th Amendment really happened and is still really law in the United States. State of New Hampshire. I, Brian Nelson Buford, archivist for the state of New Hampshire, having been duly authorized by the Secretary of State William G. Gardner to authenticate copies of records and papers kept by the Department of State, do hereby certify that the following and heretofore attached, consisting of three pages, are true copies of the original document on file at the Division of Archives and Records Management. Now here is, this is not a copy, this is an original certificate here. This is the gold seal of the state of New Hampshire. Behind that we have the record from the Journal of the House of Representatives for the state of New Hampshire, dated here December 9th, 1812, 200 years ago. And it reads, here very easily, Journal of the House. The committee appointed to take into consideration certain laws and resolutions passed by the legislatures of Georgia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, and Vermont, and other documents accompanying the same report, etc. The resolves exhibited and they further reported that it is, in their opinion, noticed expedient to adopt or approve the other proposed amendments to the Constitution of the United States, which report was accepted. Whereas His Excellency the Governor of this state has laid before the General Court a resolution passed by the Congress of the United States in the words following, to wit, resolved by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, 2/3 of both houses occurring, and here again you see the date, December 9th, 1812. In the November session, the houses occurring that following the section be submitted to the legislatures of the several states, which, when ratified by the legislatures of the three-fourths of the states, shall be valid and binding as part of the Constitution of the United States. If any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever, from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office, trust, profits under them or either of them. therefore resolved by the Senate and the House of Representatives in General Court convened that the foregoing amendment proposed by Congress to the Constitution of the United States be and the same is hereby on the part of this state agreed to, ratified, and confirmed, and be it further resolved that His Excellency the Governor be requested, to transmit copies of the foregoing resolution to the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the United States and to each of our Senators and Representatives in Congress and to each of the governors of the several states. And then it goes on to another thing. But on the back of these, we have the statement in red ink. I do hereby certify the copy of this sheet and a copy of the original document and file at the Division of Archives and Records Management, State of New Hampshire, January 12th, and signed here by Brian Nelson Buford. Same thing on the other copy of these pages. And this, ladies and gentlemen, this, what we have before us here, this is clearly part of the evidence that the amendment, the one we know as the 13th Amendment, was really the 14th Amendment. This was the original, now hidden 13th Amendment, ratified by Tennessee, North Carolina, Georgia, New Hampshire, way back in December and earlier of 1812, and was part of the reason the British invaded us, because basically we had said to them, your barristers, your lawyers, and those that hold an oath to the Great Britain, you're not even a U.S. citizen, so you can't be judges in America, you can't hold any public office at all. This has been hidden from the American people now for over 150 years now. 200 years after New Hampshire passed this resolution, this became the original 13th Amendment and was republished. And retired police officer Tom Dunn, David Dodge, discovered this in New Hampshire, an original constitution. And this relates to the interview I did about a year ago with Alfred Adask near Utopia, Texas. So what this means is that all the judges that hold office, all the lawyers that belong to a bar association, bar stands for British Admiralty Registry, or British Accreditation Registry, bar. So any member of the bar, anybody who claims they have an honor, and just when someone says, I can be a judge or I can be a member of the court system, but you can't, that is in effect claiming an honor, making you unequal. This amendment was passed specifically and precisely to make all American citizens equal, to make sure that every court position was open to election and holding by anybody, not just lawyers, not just bar associations. Because they had four bar associations out of London back in these days. We're talking 200 years. This has been hidden ever since Abraham Lincoln, also a lawyer, was president and signed and declared the emancipation of slaves in America during the American Civil War, and he renamed that the 13th Amendment. Nevertheless, from 1812 to 1860, many, many states published versions of the Constitution with 13 amendments before the Anti-Slavery Act. This is amazing. And there isn't a lawyer in the land that's going to want to believe this, and they don't want you to know about it. Because if you knew about this and you knew what the common law was, you would understand the common law protects you. The statutory law and all the other kinds of laws that they try to drag you and get you to accept as jurisdiction is in effect gutting your rights, destroying your rights.
Chomsky and I are ready to deliver the 13th Amendment because you need to know it. Students, lifelong learners, cray cray on the internet, this is a big one, so you better go get the door because the learn is here. So y'all gonna need to know the 13th Amendment. And the 13th Amendment, of course, is the first of the Reconstruction Amendments, the Civil War Amendments, and you can actually kind of group them together to at least memorize them. So just call it the 15th Amendment, 15th Amendment. And the concept is, and we're going to learn more in depth in a second, the 13th Amendment is really about abolishing slavery, about freedom for African Americans. The 14th is going to be equal citizenship, and that's a huge concept. Go watch that video. And then the 15th Amendment is going to grant voting rights to African American males. So an easy way to remember it is just to say, free, equal citizens, vote. We look at a little bit of the kind of the concept of the Constitution and slavery. Slavery is nowhere mentioned legalized in the Constitution, but there's certainly references to it as it relates to representation, like the Three-Fifths Compromise. And you can click that video right there and I'll freeze. And you just learned all about it. How great is that? There's a mention of the slave trade in there, but really no legalization of slavery. The only really, constitutional way of talking about it is through the Supreme Court and their rulings, and certainly the Dred Scott decision in 1857 kind of branded all slaves everywhere as property, and that they couldn't be citizens. So we certainly have this kind of dilemma for Lincoln as he's going into the 1864 election about what to do in the upcoming Reconstruction. Remember, the Civil War is fought from 1861 to April 1st, 1865, and we're already thinking about abolishing slavery as soon as the beginning of April in 1864, a full year before the Civil War ends and before Lincoln is assassinated. So let's take a look at kind of the nitty-gritty. Let's take a look at first the words, and then we'll quickly take a look at kind of the processes by which it was passed. So let's take a look at the words on the wall really quick.
Section 1, that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. And then Section 2, you can see on the wall, Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation.
Senator Charles Sumner actually was the first to really kind of write an amendment that went to the Judiciary Committee, and his amendment was much more flowery. The language of it was very kind of abolitionist orientated. But the Senate Judiciary Committee changed that language to a much more technical sounding wordage, and that actually comes from the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, where it talked about slavery. So the amendment was first put to the Judiciary Committee by Senator Charles Sumner in April of 1864, and we have kind of this upcoming election coming where Lincoln is running for re-election. Lincoln is under a lot of pressure to support this amendment before the election. He actually saw a free soiler, John Fremont, that was running against him in the primary and threatened to run as a third party member. So he was kind of under the guns to really support this amendment, which he did. And Fremont dropped out and he ran unopposed and he wins in 1864, campaigning on You know, I'm going to support the 13th Amendment. I'm going to abolish slavery. So here we have Lincoln running for re-election in 1864. He's coming up under pressure from the Free Soil Party to his left in terms of supporting the abolition of slavery. And he really hadn't taken a big stand before. Lincoln was worried. He was worried that when the war ended, that the idea of blacks being free from the Emancipation Proclamation could have been overturned by judiciary means. You know, he used it as a war measure. If the war was over, blacks could return to slavery. And many Republicans at that time period really found themselves supporting the idea of colonization, African colonization, sending freed blacks back to Africa. They're not even really talking yet about the 14th Amendment, about equality and citizenship. And many of the southern states, when they did ratify the 13th Amendment, did it on the back of the idea that we're not going to make these people equal with us. And even some of the radical Republicans on the floor of the House when they were arguing for this amendment really toned back their language in terms of men being equal with other men and really just seeing this as something that had to be done in terms of finishing up the Civil War. And it's a messy amendment. There's no, you know, no doubt about it. Lincoln did a lot of arm twisting. They had a little cash pot that was used to bribe many of the lame duck members into voting for it. And they needed Democrats. And there were a lot of Democrats in that 1864 election that lost their seats. These are Northern Democrats, usually from big cities, that were really against black equality, but they weren't necessarily against the Civil War. And they are really being kind of forced, in a sense, economically, to support this for their own interests. They're promised jobs with the Postmaster General. They're given, you know, cash payments in order to vote for this amendment. It passed through the Senate really quickly, but it took almost a year, I believe, in order for to get that sucker out of the House. And it doesn't happen until after Lincoln's, you know, reelected. And February 1st, 1865, Lincoln signs that amendment. And it's interesting because he's the only president that signed an amendment. The president doesn't have to sign an amendment. And actually, after he signed it, Congress had to pass a resolution that said Lincoln didn't have to sign it. But Lincoln dies, right? Lincoln dies, what, about 5-6 weeks later, April 15th, 1865. He is a victim of the assassination at Ford's Theater by John Wilkes Booth. And now we have kind of this former Democrat, Andrew Johnson from Tennessee, in charge of getting that amendment through the states. And there's also this question of whether they're states at all. Many of the southern legislatures were put together by the northern government, so there's kind of this question about legality. But Lincoln didn't want to hear anything about that. He wanted this thing to sail through, and even Andrew Johnson is going to make sure that this amendment gets enough votes in the states to satisfy that three-fourth requirement, two-thirds of both houses, three-fourths of all states. The radical Republican Thaddeus Stephen even said, "The greatest measure of the 19th century was passed and aided and abetted by the purest man in America." And you know he's talking about Honest Abe there. And we don't have Honest Abe's fingerprints over the money and the corruption and all of the side dealings going on, but it's pretty well accepted that Lincoln kind of gave the wink-wink to that process going forward. And certainly if you haven't seen the movie Lincoln, which is all about the 13th Amendment and this discussion that we're having right now, you probably should just go watch that. And the first week in December of 1865, North Carolina and Georgia become the final two states to ratify to get that three-fourths. And on December 6, 1865, the 13th Amendment is officially part of the Constitution, and we don't need that Emancipation Proclamation anymore. And certainly border state slaves never felt the freedom from the Emancipation Proclamation. But at that point, the Civil War is over, so it really doesn't matter. The next chapter, of course, is going to be that short-lived period of Reconstruction, and then we're going to quickly find not only black codes that are trying to stomp out the effects of the 13th Amendment, but certainly Jim Crow is going to be right around the corner after the Compromise of 1877. Look, there's another video, Compromise of 1877, how about that? So, abolishing slavery, that's at the heart of the matter. So there you go, you got the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment applies not only to government and the public, but it also refers to private citizens, unlike the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment. So this is an amendment that's a big blanket in terms of covering up and getting rid of slavery once and for all. Make sure that you check out other videos. If you haven't subscribed, I don't even know how to look at the camera at you anymore. How about that? Giddy up for the learning, guys. Where attention goes, energy flows. and no video would be complete without the long list of shout-outs that I'm doing for all of you that are hooking up Hip Hughes history. AJ Schwankert, I probably mispronounced your name, but you didn't mispronounce your love for Hip Hughes history with your cool donation. And certainly Donna Starboard, we know all you do for Hip Hughes history, certainly I do, so thank you for that. So that's all I got for you right now, guys. We'll see you next time that you press my buttons.
Put this on YouTube.
Yeah.
You heard this, dude.
I believe our greatest need as a people is to educate our youth. I believe that we need to move from all of the individuals and groups who are doing great things in their communities to uplift kids through better education, but we need to move from fragmentation to consolidation to coalition. They are simply products that help to create awareness.
Anytime you can put a symbol on a t-shirt that symbolizes unity, that's what we're doing.
Something for people to rally around. I use the colors of red, black, and green to reconnect African American youth with their culture. How do you know where you're going if you don't know where you've been and what you've been through as a people? At best, we are strongest together. And in that sense, I am driven and passionate about talking to as many people and groups all over this country who, again, want to help to maximize the mission, want to help to move forward our kids with better educational opportunities.